The 1999 Salt Lake Sun Sign Symposium presents session 262 of paper entitled Entering the 21st Century, Mormonism, Polygamy, and the Quest for Respectability, with Kendall White and Daryl White, with comments by Anthony Morgan.
62. Entering the 21st Century, Mormonism, Polygamy, and the Quest for Respectability. I want to remind everyone that admission to the sessions is by name tag or ticket only, so if you need to take care of that, please do so. This session has for our presenter O. Kendall White, who was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and is married to Arlene Burriston White. He has a B.S. in sociology from the University of Utah, an M.S. in sociology from the University of Utah, and a Ph.D. in sociology from Vanderbilt University. That is just some of his wide academic experience. He is widely published, and many of his publications are in conjunction with his brother, Daryl White, who is going to also be a part of the session but will not be able to be here. O. Kendall White is a professor of sociology at Washington and Lee University, and the author of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology. And he will take the first part of the session, and then Anthony Morgan will respond. Anthony Morgan is a professor in educational administration at the University of Utah. And after that, there should be 15 minutes or so for questions if you have them. So we will turn the time over to O. Kendall White.
I might need this before we're finished. Daryl would like to be here, but he has at the moment what at least I think is the most unenviable job that you can have as a professor. He's directing Spelman College's self-study in preparation for their accreditation. And if you have a good way of losing friends that you've built up over the years, you probably couldn't find a better position to do that with. So he's busy working on that throughout the summer and couldn't join us. So I'll be presenting our paper. It is our thesis that reactions of Mormon officials to recent reports of polygamous scandals in the Intermountain West portend a major doctrinal change. In their effort to establish maximum distance between the church and contemporary polygamists, LDS leaders appear to have heightened the Mormon quest for respectability. Beginning with the 1890 Manifesto, an earlier generation of church officials articulated the strategy for capitulating to federal authority. The intensity... The intensity of the current reaction suggests that the preoccupation with assimilation in American society has not diminished, and it raises questions to which we'll occasionally allude about the significance of the retrenchment hypothesis advanced by Armin Moth. I think I just saw Armin come in. Maybe I didn't hope he's here to comment on this. Our purpose, however, is to explain the current reaction to plural marriage among Latter-day Saints, the most recent event in a century of assimilation into American culture, in terms of the classical church sect model of Max Weber. formulated to understand diverse relationships of religious movements to their host societies, the church sect model remains, in our judgment, the most useful conceptual framework for explaining the domestication of deviant religions. No doctrine or practice has played a greater role in the historical demonization of Mormonism, nor created greater embarrassment for the saints in their pursuit of respectability than polygamy. Like the old soldier who will neither die nor fade away, polygamy continues to afflict the Mormons. Perhaps the only solution readily available to church officials is an actual change in Mormon doctrine. We suspect that the 21st century will witness a new Mormonism, thoroughly separated from its polygamous past. As the century ends, polygamy, plural marriage, the principle, etc., will be as familiar to Mormons as Gnosticism, female apostles, and married priests are to contemporary Catholics. Our paper begins with a description of Weber's classical church sect theory, emphasizing its value for understanding both propensities of religious movements to separate themselves from society and to accommodate and assimilate into the dominant society and culture. The same religion may exhibit both tendencies at different points in its development. We then proceed to interpret the origin of Mormon polygamy in the chaotic social environment of Joseph Smith, the experience of intense conflict with American society following Brigham Young's public announcement of plural marriage in 1852, the tortured period following the 1890 Manifesto as the formal capitulation to the federal government, the quest for respectability, including attempts to erase the stigma of polygamy as the saints assimilated in American society through the 20th century, to the contemporary challenge posed by recent public disclosures of polygamy within Utah communities. The responses of LDS church leaders to polygamy are consistent with the trajectory identified by Weber's church sect model, which we argue would predict a doctrinal change. Because of the length of the paper, we're unable to discuss the model or address the general history of Mormon polygamy in this presentation, so we'll limit ourselves to the last two sections, the contemporary scene and the impending doctrinal change. What we're presenting in terms of the material isn't dependent on the model per se, so what I'll be describing then is the events and then the conclusions that would follow from the model. As polygamy again raises its ugly head to haunt Mormons, the church is compelled to return to the question of assimilation into a broader culture. If Moss's argument that Mormonism has put the brakes on assimilation since the mid-1960s accurately reflects social reality, then the events of 1998 and 1999 have forced Mormons, especially the most assimilated, to reconsider the wisdom of retreating from the world. A number of contemporary social forces conspiring to encourage further assimilation were set in motion by the bold action of a young polygynous wife. They include the media with in-depth investigative reporting, coalescence of ex-polygamous wives into a social movement organization, the precarious position of politicians and law enforcement officials, potential backfiring of an unprecedented opportunity to showcase Mormonism during the 2002 Winter Olympics, and the lingering desire for Mormonism to be considered a New World religion. For several decades following the Short Creek disaster in 1953, the existence of polygamy among Mormon fundamentalists who descended from the official ban had been accepted as a fact of life, though historians and social scientists had shown occasional interest. Polygamy had ceased to ignite the moral outrage that it had generated in the past. Then, in the spring of 1998, the abuse story of a 16-year-old plural wife hit the news. She had walked 6 miles from a re-education camp for recalcitrant women and children to a public phone where she called the police. Her father had beaten her because she fled from a 7-month marriage to his brother, whom she shared with 14 other women. As part of the Kingston clan, known as the Davis County Cooperative or Latter-day Church of Christ, the father was formally charged with child abuse, which he originally denied, but to which he subsequently pled guilty. His brother, who was charged with incest and sexual misconduct, was tried and convicted of incest and unlawful sexual conduct. This story, as well it should, inspired extensive investigative reporting. A series of articles on polygamous communities began with the Sunday edition of the Salt Lake Tribune on June 28, 1998. Highlighting questions of welfare fraud and tax evasion, the articles examined Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona, the former Short Creek community. Both communities led their states in the lowest per capita income, lowest median age, lowest unemployment rate, lowest amount of federal income tax paid, and highest percent of families living in poverty. The reliance on Medicaid, food stamps, and the WIC program rivaled only Western Indian reservations and inner cities throughout the Intermountain West. This, however, is unlike stereotypical communities with high levels of poverty and welfare rolls. 99% of the residents are white, unemployment is virtually non-existent, and fathers have not abandoned their families. Other articles documented the disparity in tax burden for local versus state residents regarding school financing and difficulties addressing child abuse, spouse abuse, and sexual abuse in polygamous communities. Most of the attention focused on Hilldale and Colorado City, but the specific abuse cases involved the Kingston family, located primarily around the Salt Lake City area. Following the Salt Lake Tribune series, radio and television programs began covering contemporary polygamy. In February 1999, the New York Times Magazine published a lead article on polygamy in Utah, recounting the story of the abuse of John Daniel Kingston's daughter and the organization of Tapestry of Polygamy, an organization of women who have left polygamous communities. On various occasions through 1998 and 1999, national television, including Dateline, 2020, and Geraldo Rivera, carried stories on polygamy and featured spokeswomen from Tapestry, urging the prosecution of polygamists in Utah. President Hinckley himself appeared on the Larry King Live television program to deny that contemporary polygamy in Utah had any relationship to Mormonism. The electronic media especially find the story appealing, and their sensationalist reporting is reminiscent of the 19th century magazine and newspaper coverage of Mormon polygamy. With their capacity to reach mass audiences, today's media can easily keep the public conscious of the most embarrassing aspect of Mormonism, thereby exerting additional pressure on the church for the repudiation of polygamy and further assimilation into a broader national culture. We might expect Tapestry of Polygamy to become increasingly important as a source of information for journalists reporting on polygamy among fundamentalist Mormons. Since these women have lived as plural wives, their experiences and stories are invaluable, and they certainly should be told. But they are the discontented, and their perspectives are likely to vary significantly from many within polygynous communities. The media attention will also become the primary means by which Tapestry can further its agenda. We'll continue to legitimate Tapestry and its spokeswomen as the authorities on contemporary polygyny. Given the marginal status of the fundamentalist communities, few of the participants are in a comparable position to tell their stories. I might note at this point, this morning, Salt Lake Tribune, which reported the organization of polygamous wives into a group that is pushing then for the decriminalization of polygamy. And joining them, apparently, will be the Utah chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. So when I wrote this, the coalescence of that kind of organization where they might, let's say, move out of the communities into a more public confrontation hadn't occurred. However, some polygynists, apparently not directly attached to fundamentalist communities, have appeared with their wives defending plural marriage on national television programs, including the Jerry Springer Show and Dateline. The former, with the active involvement of the audience in yelling, booing, and clapping, was clearly designed to display the guests as oddities, a contemporary version of the classical freak show at the circus. Strong cultural biases against polygyny enable such media events to reinforce a presumed normalcy by encouraging overt displays of hostility toward deviance. At the same time, the audience is reminded of the historical link to Mormonism, all disclaimers notwithstanding. Again, the saints are embarrassed. Another principal source of information for journalists is academic experts. Historians and anthropologists are perhaps the most relevant. The recent anthropological record does not identify the same problems with all polygynous groups. Janet Bennett's PhD dissertation, recently published by Oxford University Press, as Women of Principle, Female Networking in Mormon Polygyny, reports little abuse and finds converts to be primarily women marginalized by church and society. Studying over 1,000 people who joined the Apostolic United Brethren Church from 1953 to 1993, she found 70% to be women. 20% of these women were related by blood to other women in the group. 15% were divorced or widowed with children. 54% were single women between 28 and 45. And 11% were married upon entering the group. The Apostolic United Brethren have the largest communities in their largest communities in Pinedale, Montana, and Bluffdale, Utah, and are believed to have 5,000 to 10,000 adherents. While Bennion describes a community where women enjoy, quote, tight-knit religious and economic solidarity with other women, unquote, Brenda Bauman, a former member of the group, claims that incest and child abuse is prevalent within polygynous families among the Apostolic United Brethren. Erwin Altman and Joseph Gnatt's Polygynous Families in Contemporary Society, published by Cambridge University Press in 1996, deals with the two largest polygynous communities in Utah. Their work identifies many of the difficulties individuals experience with the dyadic relationship, the experience of a husband and a particular wife, and their communal relationships, the simultaneous experience of a husband with all of his wives and wives with their sister wives. That much of this ground is difficult to traverse comes as no surprise, but Altman and Gannat describe both families that succeed and others that fail, with many of their problems deriving from a newness that has not resulted in sufficient institutionalization of norms to provide stable responses. But the problems are not unlike those of monogamous families, and Altman and Gannat do not report the cult-like extremes in totalitarian control, spouse and child abuse, and sexual exploitation characteristic of some recent news accounts. Caught in a precarious position, some Utah politicians have vacillated between tacit support for to explicit rejection of polygamy, while others have found an opportunity to push particular agendas. Utah Governor Mike Leavitt, whose ancestors were polygamists, initially concluded that polygamy might be protected by the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, a position he later rescinded. Senator Orrin Hatch saw an anti-Mormon conspiracy, somewhat reminiscent of the 19th century, in the investigative reporting of the Salt Lake Tribune, apparently a conscious attempt to embarrass the Mormon Church, especially in light of the 2002 Winter Olympics, had materialized. State legislators, who may have experienced the most direct pressure, proposed bills to further criminalize polygamy. Finally, following some embarrassment, the age of consent required for marriage in Utah was raised from 14 to 16. Law enforcement officials generally acknowledged that polygamy was not prosecuted unless there were other crimes, like incest and sexual or physical abuse. But by 1999, a few county prosecutors had begun the selective prosecution of polygamists. Tapestry is pushing others to follow suit. Already plagued by a growing bribery scandal with the 2002 Winter Olympics, a fresh focus on contemporary polygamy is perhaps more than church officials can tolerate. The Winter Games, with international attention focused on Salt Lake City, could provide the church with an unprecedented opportunity to showcase Mormonism. It is a public relations dream, or at least it was. But now, corrupt... Pardon? That's right. But now corruption and polygamy are bound to receive considerable attention, if not center stage. A spokeswoman for Tapestry announced on Rivera's show on CNBC that they will bring polygamy to the public attention during the Olympics if Utah has not aggressively enforced extant polygamy, incest, and abuse statutes, or enacted any additional legislation required to control, if not eliminate, polygamy. Tapestry's most powerful ally may be the Mormon Church itself. It is clearly in the interest of church officials to delineate more sharply the boundary between Mormonism and polygamy. In short, to separate Mormonism from polygamy. Today, Mormons would probably identify slavery and polygamy as the twin relics of barbarism. Earlier in the paper, there's the discussion of the early conflict between the federal government and and Utah with polygamy, and the reference there to the newly created Republican Party in 1856 with its platform to address the twin relics of barbarism, slavery and polygamy. So that's what this reference is to. Today, Mormons would, and Mormons obviously did not identify at that point polygamy as a relic of barbarism. Polygamy was superior to monogamy in Mormon arguments at that time. Today, Mormons would probably identify slavery and polygamy as twin relics of barbarism. And the saints have been no more successful in convincing the world to forget about the latter than the American South has been with the former. But forget they must if Mormonism is to enjoy the respectability that it requires to become a New World religion. Thus, polygamy, as many have argued, has been central to Mormon assimilation. Forced to capitulate at the beginning of the century, the saints have been trying to forget this peculiar institution for the past 100 years. In his recent analysis, Armand Moss argues that assimilation was so successful that the saints risked absorption into American society and culture. Consequently, in a more or less conscious effort to buttress and perhaps redefine Mormon identity, both ecclesiastical officials and the Mormon populace began re-emphasizing distinctive beliefs and practices. Since the mid-1960s, Moss argues that Mormonism has moved from church to sect rather than sect to church. It's interesting, however, that on the most distinctive aspect of Mormonism's relationship to the world, the belief and practice that most explicitly located them on the fringe of modern civilization, polygamy, there is no effort at retrenchment. Here, the saints simply do not want to be in but not of the world. They want to be in and of the world. Here, the assimilation process proceeds full steam ahead, impeded only by descending schismatic groups that keep polygamy alive and visible to a non-Mormon public. While Hardy has documented the transition from the polygamous to the monogamous ideal for the Mormon family, the most recent trends reflect still further cultural assimilation. Combined general social surveys conducted by the National Opinion Research Center between 1972 and 1996 reveal Mormons to be more conservative than the general population on issues of premarital sex, extramarital sex, homosexuality, and sex education. Moreover, a 1995 national survey of family growth found Mormons to be only slightly less likely to use birth control techniques than the general population. The differences were far less impressive than the general correspondence to national trends. Indeed, another study reported, quote, very little difference between Mormons and other women in their use of specific methods of birth control, unquote. Perhaps the most striking recent development is the change in the new edition of the General Handbook of Instructions used by ecclesiastical officials in the management of the church. For the first time, the church relaxed its opposition to birth control, indicating that, quote, the decision of how many children to have and when to have them is extremely intimate and private and should be left between the couple and the Lord, unquote. It also may hint at a de-emphasis on Mormon pronatalism, a legacy of plural marriage, with the assertion that, quote, sexual relations within marriage are divinely approved, not only for procreation, but also as a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife, unquote. The most intriguing argument about the relationship of polygamy to Mormon assimilation appears in a recent article in the Stanford Law Review by Elizabeth Harmer Dionne. Not only does she argue that Reynolds versus the United States, which is the decision by the Supreme Court that upheld the moral bigamy act, so that it basically then defined polygamy as illegal. Not only does she argue that Reynolds versus the United States forged the strategy for Mormon assimilation by separating belief from practice, but she claims that by not recognizing the relationship between practice and belief, the Supreme Court has inadvertently redefined Mormon belief. In other words, plural marriage was not simply a practice among 19th century Mormons. It was a doctrinal position that was central to Mormon theology. When the court proscribed the practice of plural marriage, it set in motion a process that resulted in the transformation of a number of central Mormon beliefs. From the redefining of doctrines of the gathering, Zion, the kingdom of God, exaltation and marriage, to the current propensity of Mormonism to become increasingly Protestant fundamentalist in its theology, the assimilation process, driven by the belief-practice distinction, has radically transformed Mormonism. To Harmer Dionne, the Mormon example has profound implications for constitutional law. She writes, quote, "If restrictions on religious practice actually change religious beliefs, then the Supreme Court must consider, more seriously than it recently has, the protection accorded those practices," unquote. Yet there are a few who seem to believe that polygamy remains sufficiently ingrained in Mormonism that it had not been a casualty of the assimilation process. Most notable is Harold Bloom, the esteemed literary critic turned religious critic, who wrote in The American Religion, quote, "No one, least of all in Salt Lake City, will be much inclined to accept a religious critic's foretellings, but I do cheerfully prophesy that someday, not too far in the 21st century, the Mormons will have enough political and financial power to sanction polygamy again. Without it, in some form or other, the complete vision of Joseph Smith never can be fulfilled," unquote. If Bloom was correct about the significance of polygamy for Mormon dreams, he failed to understand how embarrassing the practice is for contemporary church officials and how repugnant to many Latter-day Saints who envy the respectability bestowed by assimilation. Today, the saints are among the least likely to countenance polygamy. If a restoration of plural marriage is unlikely, then what is the most probable outcome? We suspect that the process described by Harmer Dionne, which is clearly consistent with the trajectory predicted by Max Weber's theoretical model, will continue to the point that the Church will formally repudiate plural marriage, dropping Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants from the official canon, or at least rewriting it to eliminate the references to plural marriage. Some scholars have begun providing the foundation for such a rationale. Eugene England, for instance, argues that monogamy, not polygyny, is the true form of celestial marriage. Though plural marriage was divinely inspired, apparently as an Abrahamic test and as a means of building social cohesion and personal commitment among the saints for a limited period of time, it also was, quote, divinely and permanently rescinded, unquote. Jesse Embry, in her review of Altman and Gannett's study of polygyny among a group of Mormon fundamentalists, is repulsed by the author's identification of their respondents as Mormon fundamentalists. She says, quote, "I'm offended because although the fundamentalists believe they're following Mormon traditions, technically they are not Mormons," unquote. Resisting the temptation to enter the debate over who has the legitimate claim to this tradition, whether it be the RLDS, the fundamentalist, or the LDS, the crucial point here is that among the Latter-day Saints, we are observing at several levels a reinvigorated attempt to separate Mormonism from polygamy. But polygamy seems a lot like athlete's foot. Just as you think you have it under control, it reappears. Of course, the scholars and intellectuals are of minor significance. Church officials ultimately will determine what happens. President Hinckley now speaks in strident terms. Appearing on the Larry King Live show, he informed the nation that polygamy is, quote, behind us, asserting that, quote, there are no Mormon fundamentalists, unquote, he proceeded to condemn plural marriage. Quote, "I condemn it, yes, as a practice, because I think it is not doctrinal. It is not legal, and this church takes the position that we will abide by the law. We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, magistrates, in honoring, obeying, and sustaining the law," end of quote. If being on the spot and offering impromptu comments on a talk show may have contributed to hyperbole and should not be taken too seriously, then Hinckley would dispel any reservations when he addressed the Mormon faithful at General Conference. He again stated that, quote, "there is no such thing as a Mormon fundamentalist," unquote. Or no, not unquote. Let me keep going here. "There's no such thing as a Mormon fundamentalist. It's a contradiction to use the two words together," unquote. Not only is polygamy illegal, now it has become immoral, and perhaps even more surprising, not doctrinal. Sounding as though he were announcing a new revelation, Hinckley declared, quote, "it is now against the law of God. Even in countries where civil or religious law allows polygamy, the church teaches that marriages must be monogamous and does not accept into its membership those practicing plural marriage." Unquote. So in addition to the embarrassment produced by contemporary polygynists claiming a Mormon heritage, the church's recent success in Africa among polygamous societies intensifies the pressure to repudiate plural marriage. Since the church's original retreat was justified in terms of the illegality of plural marriage, the Supreme Court's distinction between belief and practice that became embodied in the manifesto, successful proselytizing of Mormons in societies where polygyny is legal, poses a special problem. In fact, here is an opportunity for Mormonism to challenge the ethnocentrism of many other Christian denominations, recognizing established cultural patterns that may even be imbued with new meaning and purpose. Since polygyny is already legal, the restoration of plural marriage is clearly possible. But the LDS Church is too wedded to monogamy for this to occur, and church officials are not comfortable with the contradiction inherent in their position. The simplest resolution is a new doctrine. Occasionally, reporters, church leaders, and a few scholars claim that Mormonism repudiated polygamy with the 1890 manifesto, or at least with the second manifesto in 1904. But this is inaccurate. The church never repudiated plural marriage. It simply discontinued the practice. All of the, and it took quite a while for that to happen, all of the Mormon presidents, along with most of the apostles, during the first two decades of the 20th century, assumed the time would come when polygamy would again be legalized and the saints would live the principle. Repudiation is now likely, but its completion awaits more than a statement that plural marriage is not doctrinal. It will require the revision or removal of the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants from the Mormon scriptural canon. When this revelation was officially incorporated in the Doctrine and Covenants and accepted by the body of the church, it achieved its doctrinal status. Though the 1890 Manifesto has also become part of the official canon, it suspends the practice but does not repudiate the doctrine. Repudiation can be complete only when this revelation is dropped from the canon, rewritten so as to eliminate the references to plural marriage, or another revelation actually denies its doctrinal status. The most probable scenario is the rewriting of Section 132. At the end of the 21st century, plural marriage may be as familiar to Latter-day Saints as female apostles, married priests, and non-hierarchical organization are to contemporary Catholics. Thank you.
Nice to follow someone short so I don't have to adjust the microphone like I usually do. I had an opportunity to read the full paper of the Whites and found it a very interesting paper. I hope it will be published so that all of you may have the privilege of reading the entire paper. It's very interesting both in terms of the framework that it uses to analyze the issue, which, as he mentioned, is Max Weber's sect church ideal types, and its discussion of the origin, development, and possible demise of polygamy as a practice and a belief. My comments here are aimed principally at inducing some discussion, and I'll make six or eight points. One is Weber's framework for understanding the movement of charismatic sects along the continuum toward churches, or in the American context, denominations, which might be characterized as a natural history of religious movements, or as some organizational theorists would term it, kind of an organizational life cycle movement. And both of these are really variants on a theme of stage theory. Armin Moss and others postulate an alternative approach, an optimal tension or equilibrium model that challenges the more or less unidirectional prediction of the classic Weberian movement from sect to church. This optimal tension model allows a religious sect to strike a balance and keep that balance, remaining in a state of dynamic tension, suffering sufficiently distinct from the dominant religious culture, yet not be regarded as an extreme or weird cult that would deter growth beyond those willing.